We are now recording. This is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, as always. This is
Abe. Aaron, how are you?
I'm doing well. It's been a
good day.
There you go.
Can't complain. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing well. We're recording this at night, but it's not a night's episode.
No, but this is Out Now, a film podcast where we normally discuss new movies weekly. However, every now and then we do have special bonus episodes, whether it's one of our fun commentary tracks or something a little different. This is pretty straightforward, a little different, but it's just a straight up review of the film Abigail.
Mm-hmm.
From Radio Silence team, directors Matt Bettinelli Open and Tyler Gillette. And we're gonna talk about Abigail. That's the entire purpose of this bonus episode.
Full spoilers, baby.
We'll go full spoilers. We'll give some initial thoughts and everything, but then we'll eventually go into the spoilers of it all.
Sure.
But yeah, let's do it. Let's get to our main review for Abigail.
You all came highly recommended. You know the rules. No real names, no backstories, no cell phones.
So whose kid is she?
A very wealthy man who's about to be $50 million poorer.
I'm here to make sure you're safe.
What's your name? Mine's Abigail.
You can call me Joey.
Do you have any kids?
I have a little boy.
See you in 24 hours.
Do you know what a Pinky Promise is? If you behave and do as we say, like Pinky Promise you, it'll all be over soon.
Joey?
Yeah?
I'm sorry about what's going to happen to you.
All right. That should have been some of the trailer for Abigail. I'm just going to read the plot description that I see here. It says, after a group of criminals kidnap the ballerina daughter of a powerful underworld figure, they retreat to an isolated mansion, unaware that they're locked inside with no normal little girl.
Whoa.
I know, right?
I know.
The film stars Melissa Barrera, Dan Stevens, Catherine Newton, Kevin Durand, William Catlett, Angus Cloud, Giancarlo Esposito, and Alicia Weir as Abigail. Abe, yes. I want to know, what did you think of Abigail?
Very entertaining movie. This movie has a lot going for it in that it's playing with a lot of different genres, and it also enables it to, or the directors have kind of chosen to kind of have like this quote unquote like bottle film, but they're very used to movies like this where it kind of takes place in one location, as evidenced by their previous film, Ready or Not. Is it called Ready or Not?
Yes.
Or Hide and Seek?
Ready or Not.
Yeah. And I think that it's very entertaining. I think that it doesn't really like offer much. I'm kind of really bummed that the marketing kind of let you in on some of the secrets, because I think I tried to stay away as much as possible. I've seen the trailer without sound, but still it was kind of really fun just to explore this. And when I'm watching it, I think everybody here is doing a really good job. Angus Cloud, strong streaming presence. Last movie, it's great to see them. But I think really what pulls it off is Melissa Barrera is really good in this, along with Dan Stevens. And that really helps out when you're trying to make a movie about a 12-year-old who is a vampire. And because they have some motives internally for what they're trying to seek out of this movie during the runtime, it is quite compelling. And obviously the Radio Silence boys, no stranger to just blood explosions. And I kind of wish that there was actually a little bit more of that. But I can't really, beggies can't be choosies, as what Homer Simpson says. So yeah, I find it really entertaining. How about you?
I don't have two minds on the marketing of it. Like, it's a first act thing. I don't really know how you get around selling this movie without including that, because it's like, why do you go to this? And it's even if you just hint that the girl is up to no good, it's like, I mean,
doesn't really sell it.
Like, what does that sell? It's like, yeah, I've seen Home Alone. Like, what else do we do with that? It's like, so it's like that. I can't say that bothered me, like, knowing that key element. And I know some have complained about the film like taking a while to get to something they already knew, as far as like when the quote unquote the fun begins or whatnot. Uh-huh. And I wouldn't say I'm not in that line of thinking. I actually was having a good amount of fun with the initial stuff with this group of people.
Yeah.
In the way that you can when it comes to like heist movies or kidnapping films like this one, where the characters do not know each other, therefore they're all kind of on edge because they're feeling each other out. I was enjoying that out because I like, and that's mainly because I like this cast. I like the assemblage of people here. It's a, you know, mix of you know, solid actors, character actors, comedic actors. I think that works in the film's favor. Overall, I think this movie is good. I wish I liked it more, but I like it fine. I think it does the job that it's going for with just, I don't say missed opportunities, but it feels like for a movie that's longer than I think it needs to be, I wish it used that time that it has a little bit better in some areas.
Yeah.
For example, it's not that I need like more character stuff because there's a lot of it, but this movie like it has two different sequences where there's info dumps on who these people are. And it's like, that's a lot of time spent on telling us who people are. Instead, we could explore more of who Abigail is to some degree. Like what is it about ballet that makes it works for her? Like I feel like just her being a ballerina, that's a fun thing just to say ballerina vampire, but it's like, well, why does she do ballet? Like there's just like stuff there I feel like could have been explored more. Or the vampire powers, I feel like we kind of use them and then dump them, where I might have liked to see more of A, B, or C as far as things that Abigail is capable of. Now that doesn't take away that I had fun with this movie. It's just like those, if I'm trying to like narrow down my gripes, cause I walked away being like, oh, I wish it was better.
Yeah.
But I still liked it. I did like it. I had fun with it. The other thing is I feel like Radio Silence, between this and their Scream movies, and even Ready or Not to an extent.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Scream.
Even, you know, between all of their films so far, I think they're a solid group. I feel like every one of their scripts always could use like just one more run for a punch up.
I hear
you. As far as like clever lines or whatnot. Because I think like the scripts are good conceptually, and I think there's fun to be had with these characters. But I always feel like we're like one notch below like what the sharper version of the script could have been.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of that aside, yes, I had fun with this movie. I think it's a good time. I think the use of this one location leads to a lot of like cool ideas and macabre stuff involving ways to get to bloody set pieces or what have you.
Yeah.
I agree with you that Pereira and Stevens are bringing it. Stevens in particular is just like between
Stevens this, is like having a ball.
This and Godzilla, it's like, God, give Stevens all the stuff. And he's got another film, Cuckoo, coming out in the summer that he looks super fun in. So I'm like,
yeah. Stevens, but for him being like a character actor kind of coming up in movies like this, like smaller, strange, creepy movies, he knows what he's doing.
He does, and I like seeing him just having this kind of fun here, where he's just playing these characters in genre films that are just like, there's a charisma there that I enjoy. Because like this movie, he's more not unlikable as far as screen presence, but he's unlikable as far as he's the least fun character of that set of people that you're following. Where like Godzilla, he's the most fun character of the people. You want to hang out with him.
I mean, he's doing like giant dentistry over in Godzilla.
Yeah, in this movie, like, sure, he's fun to watch, but I wouldn't want to hang out with this guy. He seems like an asshole.
Well,
like,
yeah, exactly. The asshole factor is high, and I think that you if you had to like pick, you know, dodgeball teams, you probably wouldn't want to be on his team because he seems like, yeah, a dick, right?
You try to lead the team. I'm like, I'm the captain here. Maybe like, I'm the captain now. I was like, don't quote Marquette at me. But no, I think, yeah, there's fun to be had in like watching this cast interact, watching them deal with a situation they did not, you know, expect by any means.
Yeah.
And the fact that it gets as gory and bloody as it does, despite a limited cast, I was like, okay, there's a lot of blood in this. Like, all right. I was all for that. I will say, even if you subtract the like she's a vampire thing, as far as like just the plot of this movie, I never felt like I was surprised at any step.
I know. Yeah,
like it goes through certain motions where it's not unentertaining because of that, but it's like the idea of where are we going to go and who's going to get out of certain situations, I never like felt like, oh, I can't believe they went already. Like, I mean, it's you know, I was pretty
you kind of know, yeah, you kind of
pretty
know
clear like what the
there.
Through line of this movie was going to be. Right. But there's still like it does come down to just the fun that you're having watching these people deal with this extreme situation. And so having them, Kevin Durand also very fun here.
He's very fun, yeah. Playing a Quebecois guy.
Yeah, so it's though I enjoyed this movie. I wish I liked it a little more, but no, I had fun for sure.
Yeah, I want to go on something that you were talking about earlier with Abigail and kind of the reveal of her and whatever else before we get into like full spoiler territory. I think what I enjoyed about that part of it is that there was like a slow-ish reveal of what's going on with her character and her backstory. And there is an ultimate reveal of like, you know, these people are here for various reasons, right? Beyond their own self-motivations. That was interesting. I hear what you're saying on the front of, well, you know, if you explore that a little bit more, if there was actually something that is much more dramatic, that would have been probably extra fun just to have that. The other thing I want to point out is the gore factor? No, it wasn't the plot. Oh, one of the criticisms that I had around this movie, minus like what you're saying around the runtime and also maybe like some of the exposition dumps, where I agree with you is I kind of wish that they had given me a better understanding of the lay of the house, because that was kind of annoying, where it's like, okay, well, where is this kitchen in reference to where Catherine Newton is hiding out, kind of thing? Or what is this extra layer here? Like they kind of do this in Ready or Not as well, where the house is quite large, but that's more of like an estate, because she actually gets to go outside in that movie. I mean, this movie, they're all kind of like just in this labyrinth style home. And it would have been more fun if we kind of are able to kind of see around turns, so to speak, where I'm like, oh, well, you know, why would you guys go here? You guys are clearly going to go back to Abigail's room or something like that.
I guess it does have a tendency to be like we just insert characters in places without like giving much of a map to how they got to those
like,
places.
Here's like a new part of the house, like what? And like it's fun, but also it can be a little bit it's not even jarring. It's more just like I kind of just want to know where this is in relation, because it seems to be a pretty large house. They have to go to like libraries, they have to go to like foyers, they have to go to whatever else. And it could be a little bit more mapped out,
I suppose. I would say I didn't feel that as a necessity to make this like stronger necessarily, but I get the point that you're making, because mm-hmm. I can agree that there's, you know, people that are just like in areas that are not even like nondescript. They're just like, okay, I guess they're in this room now, but where's this room again? Like, yeah, it just did.
Yeah.
You
want to do it?
I was gonna say before we get to like spoiler stuff. Uh-huh. What was I going to say? I was going to say something. It's going to be profound. It's really going to change.
the state of horror movies today in the 21st century with small box set or with small budgets, smaller budgets.
I mean, this is a fairly big budget movie that's bombing currently. So no,
what's
not
the
that.
Budget on this? 50?
It's 28, which is
okay. Less than I thought, but yeah,
it's still, if you, I hear you. For a horror movie, I mean, going over 10, it's like, okay. I guess
especially like in the Blumhouse era where everything is like 10, 15, yeah, even less.
I mean,
than
this,
that, right?
This is to its credit, it's a Universal picture, and they got a budget to make a real movie,
sure,
which I'm, you know, not against whatsoever. It's a good looking movie.
I mean,
they use the stuff well. They have a solid cast. It's the third of three Universal vampire movies in like the past year. So I mean, we got that.
What was the other two?
Renfield and The Last Voyage of the Demeter, of course.
Oh wow. Okay, yeah. I mean, good vampire effects in both of them.
Yeah. And this one similar, it has, I think, a good use of effects. I can't think of what I wanted to say. So I mean, I get the if unless you have anything else, I just say we'd go into spoilers so we can kind of delve in more.
I am bummed, like in general, I guess I'm just bummed that Melissa Barrera is not going to be in the next Scream franchise for various reasons. And it kind of, I was thinking about her, I was like, I wonder, I was going to present this question to you, which is like, does she now fit in the category of like one of our, like our 21st century Scream queens? And it's kind of just a bummer that she won't be in Scream 8, I guess.
I mean, with Radio Silence not coming back either, let alone Jenna Ortega, it's like the story that they were specifically telling for this set of films. I mean, it, you know, none of them are back at this point. So it's like, well, I mean, whatever unrealized story that's going to be, that is what it is, I guess.
Nev Campbell's going to be like, they're all dead in the opening sequence of the first one. And then she's just like, I'm going to go get Matthew Lillard again. He's not dead yet.
In terms of like Scream Queen's dad, I mean, yeah, she's in, you know, two Scream movies. This, I mean, sure. I mean, she's done well in horror movies. You know, I don't know
how that's defined. That's why it's like, is there like a minimum that people think?
It's not a real. It's more just like being well known for, you know, icon. Like, I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis being a Scream Queen that came from eventually doing it, like, cause she does that, and then she eventually does Prom Night and Terror Train and what have you. But she like having the status
genre movies,
having the status of Scream Queen kind of was already on her even before she kind of, cause she like, she specifically didn't try to like take too many on before she eventually sort of did. But because, you know, Halloween was such a monster hit for the time, she was just already kind of, and she was, you know, she's the daughter of Janet Leigh from Psycho. Yeah. So it's like, that kind of works for her.
Yeah,
others. Sure. A lot of times it's like just like the final girls that, you know, managed to stick around or whatnot. So, I mean, I don't think there's like a rough itinerary or criteria when it comes to like, how do you become a Scream Queen?
Yeah.
Like between Barrera and Jenna Ortega, who's, you know, she's Ty West's ex, and she's in Wednesday. I mean, she's doing a lot of horror genre stuff. So it kind of keeps her in that.
Yeah.
In that realm as well.
I mean, you had to also add that Melissa Barrera is like the final girl in the Heights. So, you know,
exactly.
That's a horror movie, right?
She stays.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So she survived.
What's her name? Leslie Gray. She leaves. She goes back to Stanford or whatever. Right? So it's.
All right, let's do this.
I guess they do leave. They stay in the Heights, right? They
she's the one that actually leaves. She goes to go pursue her career in costume design, right?
Well, but she was still going to be in the city, but she was going to move to out of the Heights, but then she got with Usnavi, so now they both live in the Heights together. She just has like a better job.
I love that we're recapping in the Heights.
We have to make sure to get this right. The people care.
The film that came out like 5 years ago.
And people and the play's been around for such a long time.
Right.
this matters.
It's all canon in the
because Usnavi, he's like remodeled the bodega, and now he's with his wife, with Vanessa, Melissa Barrera's character, and they stayed in the Heights. The movie's called In the Heights. We kind of should have seen this.
They have to stay there.
Like, who is Jimmy Smith going to point at if they left?
Well, I mean, he's going to point out all these, like, you know, young hipster people that are just like, get out of here. You don't know this neighborhood.
Exactly.
As he, like, does, like, a flamenco dance.
Mm-hmm. Good morning. Okay, so spoilers.
Spoilers. All right, let's hit it.
All right. So a lot of people die bloody, bloody deaths.
Yes. I wish there was more.
Well, so you say that, and I mean,
You have a limited number of people here, which is, you know, you can't really have everyone exploding all the time. But I do enjoy when Radio Silence kind of goes crazy. It's not that, I think it is like the right amount for this movie, because like what you said earlier, they have kind of set up a lot of the first half of this movie. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very comedic in what it's doing for almost all the things that happened in this movie, including all the dance scenes and stuff. But yeah, hit it.
I with the exploding body stuff, like, who doesn't like a good exploding body? But I will say at the same time, a lot of people turn into vampires, which I'm not sure if I like that or not, as far as how many people turn into vampires
in movies in general, in this movie. Okay.
As far as like how to raise the and that contributes to how long this movie is, because there's people like, you know, making dramatic changes to who they are, or what have you. Like, I think it works with the Catherine Newton thing, just because it gives you that whole, like,
That's the first one.
It has like the mind control stuff that's going on.
Yeah. Well, that one plays the nice game of like, will she, won't she?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. It increases like a level of tension because this is a new vampire movie. Therefore, we don't know what the exact rules are. So that gives us like a sense of what it is. By the time we get to Dan Stevens, it's like this movie has a number of endings at this point, and it's like, okay, so now we're Now we need Frank to become like the main.
Do you want to tell everybody how Frank becomes a vampire?
He gets bitten by a vampire.
By Giancarlo Esposito, who's been there the whole time.
Yes, Giancarlo, who is also a vampire.
He's like watching them smoking cigarettes in the basement. Again, another room that I don't know where this is.
Well, that's specifically a secret room on purpose. I mean, that you're not supposed to know that room exists.
I know. Yeah.
But yes, he is a vampire, and therefore, and he makes a deal with Dan Stevens' character. By the way, the fact that they give them all nicknames is the Rat Pack. That's fun.
That's pretty fun. That. Yeah.
Although, like, again, like having exposition dumps where you're like, let's now say this is who you really are and this is your deal. It's like, I don't need more names. I'm not going to remember those. Like, come on.
I mean, the first time that they did that, that was fun because there is an element of, oh, they know too much about me, or they know too much about all of us because, you know, they do kidnap this girl from her home, and then she coaxes Marissa LeBrere to help her take off her mask. And Dan Stevens fucking hilariously goes in the room and then like goes right back out. And when he says, oh, fuck, I was just like, this is Dan Stevens is so good.
He says, oh, fuck, like covers his hand, his mouth of his sleeve. Exactly. And
then he pulls a gun on this kid. And I was like, did you see my face?
But he was wrong. Like it's only supposed to be her that goes in there. And that's
right. Yeah. Yeah.
Breaking the rule.
Right. He's breaking his own rules. Yeah. But the comedic nature of Dan Stevens, but also how funny this script is from time to time, including with some of the violent stuff is pretty good.
You have like the scene of Angus Cloud, who's like saying like who everybody is and he's wrong. Then you have Barrera like going over. It's like, that's fun enough because it's a good way to get us to know things without it being hammered into us.
Yeah.
But yeah, then later on, it's like, and now this, it's like, okay, let's keep learning stuff. Like, be more economical with how to distribute certain kinds of information.
Now, are you saying that you would have preferred if they didn't have any of the backstory, you just kind of stick with like their names?
It's not a matter of whether or not they did it. It's just more of execution. Like, sure. I don't think I was just a fan of how they chose to do it.
In terms of
structuring, as far as having... Sure. Basically, yeah, you have three characters saying what everyone does. That's just saying that sounds like too much.
I hear what you're saying because it happens twice in like one scene too. But I didn't mind it because of where it happens. Because again, they kidnap Abigail. They are all just like lounging at this point, and then they are kind of like playing quote unquote like parlor tricks, right? And it made sense to me, but it is, I can see where it does eat into time because of it's an inefficient use of like 5 minutes of exposition, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I want to ask you about Abigail.
Mm-hmm.
What did you were referencing earlier, like, hey, you know, she's got different powers. I would like to explore that. But also you were saying it's kind of a, I don't know if you did or did not like that she was basically the leader of the gang kind of thing, right? Like this is her mob empire, and she's
her dad's know, the leader of the Dracula is the leader of the
sure
gang.
Yeah
she's his enforcer
the, yeah she's the enforcer yeah she's the Kaiser Soze of the group.
No, that's not, I mean that I like that's yeah. Neat. I don't know if I needed like No, I don't need like because it's set in this location. I don't need to know more about that. It's more of because she's a vampire and we learn her powers.
Yeah.
But like, here's a power, and then we don't use that power again. Then here's another one. Then we have flying. She like fly twice.
It's a $28 million movie, Aaron.
Flying? Just put them on wires. That's not expensive. Yeah, wires.
I like the way that they shot that scene where she's lifting Dan Stevens and he's like, oh, fuck, she's flying. She's like flying up the staircase kind of thing. Like this is fun to see. So you would have liked to see more flying from her.
Just more. Yeah. More uses of some of these powers. I don't know how exactly, but it's just like it felt like I was given something that it was like, and now that's not a thing anymore. And it's like, she's how powerful. Like it's a matter of, I guess, understanding how powerful this person is supposed to be, and given the numerous times that Dan Stevens and gang are like, let's go charge her with a stake again, it just like it's walking a line of like, how dumb are our characters, how much can we tolerate seeing them get their asses handed to them, which to the movie's credit, the fact that they're all like, you know, criminals that kidnapped a little girl means that we don't really need to care that much about whether or not they live or die.
Sure.
Like that, you know, that makes it okay. So it's a matter of, I guess, balance is what I'm asking for.
Yeah. I viewed it as, well, Abigail's also like this trickster lady woman girl, you know what I mean?
She's
doing all this because she's super bored. She's not bored because of the people there. Again, they're there because they have wronged her family's business in some way, which is a fun reveal. But I like the way that she just fucks with them and she's like, no, I'm gonna let you guys, like, you know, I'm not gonna kill you guys all at once. I could easily do that. I'm just gonna, you know, run away from Dumber Time and then go back to my hijinks in some other part of the house, which it does elongate the movie, right? Mm-hmm. It's not really helpful when you don't really know what she's up to, but you hear all the hijinks that these guys are up to. And it's fun for me when, you know, they go find her. And it does become, like you said earlier, this Home Alone style thing where she's not really setting up traps necessarily, but she, again, is allowing them to try and discover her in some capacity. And she's just going to beat him up with whatever she needs to do. I really like the scene where they are trying to get her. And she's just like dancing with a decapitated Angus Cloud. And she's like, oh, no, they found me. She drops the body. Like, this is disturbing, but it's also like some dark humor type stuff. And I dig that.
Yeah, like that first attempt that they make to try to get her, like, I enjoy because, like, what's this going to be? And,
yes. And
we get it. We get what that is. So I guess it's, once again, it's a matter of how many more times can we see them try to use the whole stake thing where it's like, that's not working, guys. Like, you need a new plan. Like, that's not the one that's going for.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but then you get cool things like, you know, like a swimming pool full of bodies and stuff. And
yeah, that was gross.
When I'm like, yeah, it is. And it introduces like stuff like that. I'm like, I'm into this. I'm into like finding new things like this to get into.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a matter of how much time are we spending with these different aspects of things. And so that's like where my, the consternation I have with this movie is, where it's
consternation.
Like,
SAT 1600.
There's enough like stuff that I like that's really fun in this movie, but it feels like there's just ways to like shake up these pieces a bit more to make it feel like there's either more going on within the amount of time that they have to do it, or stuff we could take out so we could just, you know, to tighten it up a bit.
Yeah, it runs like an hour and 40 some odd. I'm curious, like, where you might do some cutting minus the exposition.
It's the exposition stuff mainly. That's
the
amount of scenes involving Dan Stevens has a stake and he attempts to kill Abigail, and it's like, guy,
at least three times with like a hobbled leg too.
Yeah. or when it, like, it's, you know, how dumb can we treat the audience, or the, you know, how dumb can we let these characters be while the audience is like well ahead? So like Abigail being in a jail, I'm like, she is a vampire. She is literally super strong. Like, this is just, her being in a jail is not holding her back right now.
That's actually not even what I thought of. Because what I thought of, like, they tell this story about like, hey, you know, like Dan Stevens was like this cop, and then he kind of got into deep, like Donnie Brasco style, and he couldn't really tell the difference. And then he finally got back to his senses and got these three police lieutenants, you know, on trial, and they don't know how these people got murdered and ripped to shreds. And I was like, well, why would you guys put her in a cage? She could turn into like a bat, presumably. You know what I mean? So like, what are we doing here? Like, she can fly, yes. And she can like dislocate her arms and joints and stuff. But it would have been, I hear what you're saying on that front. That's why I was like, I don't know why you guys think that this cage is going to hold her.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. It's just there's no point where I thought they should feel safe because right. She's in a cage now. It's like, God, let alone Dan Stevens keeps getting like very close to the cage. You're like, she could rip your throat out easily. Like, get
easily.
Stop sitting next to the cage.
But I think that's why the stupidity of Dan Stevens' character is why it's like, I whatever happens to him is actually going to be fine to me, because yes, he's an asshole for one, but also it has established itself as somewhat off the beaten path comedic.
No, I get that. And that's why I'm saying, you know, one other pass at the script to make it a little sharper or what have you. That's the kind of thing that could be helped. Sure. You know, I'd have less of these concerns, or I'd be thinking less hard about some of these things if it would kind of rounded out some of these edges a little bit more.
Yeah. And so as much as I'm saying around how comedic the script might be, I think where you're also getting at is like there might be like some tonal unevenness, because there's some serious stuff that happens too, including with like our character Rickles, right? So Rickles and Melissa Barrera, Joey's character, they are kind of uncertain of the situation, and they kind of make a pact together. Mm-hmm. And that's more serious than all the hijinks that we've been seeing up to that point too. But that also like goes away very quickly.
Yeah. And it's the kind of thing where just casting alone, I'm like, well, that's not going to last. Like it's the one actor who like,
I've seen that guy before.
Not in many things, and not in the way where like prominent billing doesn't go with him in the same way.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, I'm pretty sure Angus Cloud's going to go first because he's like the worst of them and he's the youngest of them. Yeah, so it's like, sure. Well, he's out. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I know what this movie's going to be as I'm going through it. And like, that's not inherently a problem. But if you're going to present me with a new vampire movie, I'd like to not be like ahead of every single turn that it has.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. Because when they do have their first fight, that does establish some of the rules, because they're talking about garlic steaks, and they never really directly bring up sunlight, but sunlight comes into factor later. Well, that's fine.
I like the instantness of sunlight. I like how it's like the second sunlight hits them, explosion. Like, that's fun. Like when her hand explodes because of sunlight, it's like, that's a cool thing.
Oh,
like
yeah.
I like that. Was very From Dusk Till Dawn.
And immediate growback. Yes, yeah. Very, very reminiscent of that. I want to ask you about our boy Matthew Good.
Okay.
Fun?
Super fun. Matthew Good shows up as not Dracula. I mean, he's Dracula. He's just like, they're not saying the name, but he's Dracula.
Main vampire guy. Yeah.
He's, you know, he's even says like, you know, I've gone by many names, right? He's like, yeah, we know. Dr. Acula, got it. Like, good job.
The musical?
The musical. I mean, this movie was like originally going to be like an adaptation of Dracula's Daughter.
I heard this.
This current version of this movie has nothing in common with Dracula's Daughter, so it doesn't really matter at this point. Uh-huh. But that's where this film came to life, as being initially pitched that way. But it's just, you know, now it's just like a reference point, because it's not even like based on it in any capacity.
Yeah.
But regardless, Matthew Good comes in here. Good casting. I enjoyed that.
I was surprised.
it was fun to see him pop up in here, even if it's another ending tacked on to a movie that ended already. I'm like, that makes sense. Her father has to come in here at some point. That's that they talked about him so much, he might as well have an appearance in this movie. And I like Matthew Good for the most part. I think he's generally works when he's used. I still think he was miscast in Watchmen, but fine, it's okay. It's been
as Ozymandias
in many years. Yes.
Yeah. Matthew Good in this movie, I thought it was good too. I think that I was just surprised by how gaunt he looks. But I was like, it makes sense. He's a vampire. Actor.
Vampire. Not many fat vampires walking around.
But I like
your pearl and blade. There's no fat vampires.
I don't know. Maybe we'll see one in the Mahershala Ali version of it. I guess Violator from Spawn is not a vampire. He's just like a weird clown dude.
Yeah, just a clown demon.
Yeah. But when he shows up there.
Why am I typing fat vampire into Google right now?
Yet we have to find out. Good reveal. And I dug that he's playing it differently too, which I think goes to why I think that this movie has not just tone problems, but again, like what you're saying, can we get to where we need to go? Like some of the pacing is a little bit off. Because yes, you're right. This movie already ends prior to that. And then it has this tacked on ending. Which I was thinking to myself, well, here it goes where everyone just dies. That would have been fine by me too, but that's not what happens.
Yeah, I think the problem is like the stakes at that point. It's like, if you're going to introduce Vampire Daddy, mm-hmm. like, should I like feel that Melissa Barrera is like back under threat once again? Because I don't. Yeah. So I'm like, they're not going to get her this far and then be like, we killed her because of some character you've never seen before. Yeah. Shows up in the last 2 seconds. Like that's not a satisfying movie.
Right.
So it's like, and I'm not saying like, it should have been a mid-credit scene where Matthew Good comes in, but it's like,
No. I don't think I needed to see more Matthew yet. I think I actually got the right amount of.
No, I mean, like, you know, like she leaves and then like mid credits, then Matthew Good comes in for the first time in the movie. And it's like, Abigail, what have you been up to? Or something.
Oh.
You know, that kind of a thing.
And she's like, I'm just playing with my food. Wink.
Actually, I feel like there is a way to do something like that if they wanted to.
To have Matthew Good.
To have it like a mid credit scene where Matthew Good comes in as the father, you know, as Dracula, and she's like, you know, playing with the bodies or something, doing something weird.
Yeah.
Or, you know, explaining her love of ballet. And then I'd be like, oh, finally, I got to know why she's doing ballet.
it's a Kirsten Dunst situation. She just got turned when she was like 12, you know, back in the day. And she was probably coming back from ballet practice back then, too. Just one of those things that you just become really good at over centuries of living.
We didn't talk about the dance sequence, by the way. The big dance
sequence. The dance sequence?
Yeah, with Abigail and Catherine Newton's characters.
Oh, okay.
She's conducting her under her, sure, her magic powers.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's a fun sequence.
I like that there was like details like she's slowly burning, too, because there's like seeps of sunlight coming through the
window. Yeah, she's like smoky.
Yeah, she's smoky. Yeah. And then they're both doing I was surprised by the flexibility of Catherine Newton. I was like, oh, that's good. Maybe she was also a ballet dancer, or the choreography they practiced quite a bit. But yeah, it was fun. Again, where is this in the house? Right. So that's
yeah, up the stairs, up in the rafters.
I guess it looks like an indoor sun or an indoor, greenhouse type thing, like, you know, where Morticia Adams is working when she finds Dr. Binderschloss after the day
there.
Or in the next day, you know. So yeah, I also want to talk about some of these death scenes. We talked about Catherine kind of exploding, but you know, Kevin Durant, he doesn't die, but when he gets like stabbed by a thousand times by like the tiny cross in his hand, on his chest, I was like, I don't think he's dying. I don't think he's dead. And yeah, the script is like, no, he's not dead.
No, yeah, it just hurts. He's just a big guy.
And he's just like taking a brutal beating here, but he's not dead. I was like, okay, good, because this wouldn't have made any sense if like all of a sudden she's able to kill people.
What does he die from eventually?
Catherine Newton kills him.
That's right. She like bites him a bunch, right?
Yeah, she just like rips out his throat and then she starts eating him.
Yeah.
So yeah. But everyone here doesn't have I don't think there's really a satisfying death per se.
It's Dan Stevens. He's the one that's a satisfying death.
Yeah, but that's because we have to like spend all this extra time with him too.
I mean, but if you're asking for a satisfying death, it's like, well, you want to see him die eventually, and he does, and he gets exploded, and it's great. Like it's fun to watch.
This is true.
The Catherine Newton one's just more clever, if anything, because they establish that there's like reflection or like the sunlight, and then there's like the reflective metal tray.
Yep.
And it's just a matter of like, oh, they ran into the room. Oh, she got the thing, and she's reflecting the light off the thing, and it killed. It's like, okay, that's all that one. All right.
Yeah. Well, that one is fun because I was not her death is fun too because the explosion.
I was like, it's fun and clever as opposed to like, oh, we really got to see that Sammy die. Like, that's not what I was thinking. It's just more of the way it happens. Like, oh, that was cool.
Yeah, yeah. But again, the lead up to all that stuff, not when she's a vampire already, but the lead up of, well, we see her get bitten and she's asking the same questions that we're asking, which is like, am I going to turn into a vampire? And then she does the same things that I think everyone is thinking in the theater, which is, they're in this room here now with the sunlight, and I don't know if she can go in the sunlight. And so she even stops herself and says, I'm going to test this out here. And we think that she's fine. And turns out that vampires have mind control.
Yeah. They got a taste of them so they can go. It's a variation of a vampire thing as far as they can get them under their spell if they've tasted their blood at some point.
Yeah. I want to ask you about Radio Silence and I guess their future, because they've done a lot of things that you've seen, like some VHS stuff. And this seems, did they do the exploding cult thing?
No, that's Gareth Evans from The Rain.
Okay, because I was like, when things started exploding, I was like, is that them? But
no, but I mean, Ready or Not had tons of explosions.
Like, yeah, tons of explosions, especially like at the end.
But yeah, no, they're in the, they did the one of the episodes, they did like the concluding one of the first VHS, which is one of the better entries in that, in the first
the
movie.
Vampire Lady Girl?
No, that's like the first one in VHS. Oh. No, this is the last one where it's like a bunch of guys go into a Halloween party, and then the Halloween party turns into like crazy. There's like they see like an exorcism, and the people at the exorcism like see her, and then they like it comes this like crazy like ghosts are chasing them type of thing. And
I think wild. I remember this one. Yeah,
it's wild. It's a lot of fun. Because it's very like high energy or whatnot.
Yeah.
And they had like, because there's, what is it? That's Southbound. Yeah, Southbound is another like anthology film.
Uh-huh.
And then, yeah, then it's Ready or Not, Scream, Scream 6, this. Mm-hmm. There's Devils Do. That's what there's like, it's a found, that's that found footage film with, what's his name? Matt Saracen.
QB1.
Yeah, Zach Guilford.
He's like, in Saracen.
Whenever he's in a, whenever he's in something, you're like, well, this guy's doomed. Like, it's like, his entire career is, well, I don't want to be around this guy. He's got to be killed.
Let's not split up because he's definitely going to die.
If you're splitting up, I'm going over here.
Like, yeah, exactly.
You do your
what
thing.
What order does he die in, the movie where everybody can be violent for a night?
What, The Purge?
The Purge, yeah. He's one of the last ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Purge Anarchy. That's the one he's in.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's one of the later okay. ones. Yeah.
But still goes.
Yeah, you can't be near him. it's towards the end. Yeah.
Okay. In large part, I kind of just want to round things out by saying you're talking about budget and how this mm-hmm. movie cost $25 million. Again, other movies that have come out in this genre of horror are a little bit cheaper. Off air, we're kind of talking about Imaginary and Night Swim. But I'm curious your thoughts on like this movies like this. You and I talk about them, which is, hey, if people have ideas and they can make mid-budget, low-budget movies, they need your support. People should go see them. And I hope that this experiment doesn't go, it's not an experiment, but I hope that this trend doesn't go away. I think that it's just really tough right now with these mid-budget movies, as we've heard in Oscar speeches and whatever else, like, please give more money to mid-budget movies. I'm curious your thoughts on where the mid-budget movie stands right now.
I mean, there's a number of different contexts to apply. Like, this is a horror movie. Horror is its own thing. It's a reliable genre. It's just that horror tends to be a lot cheaper. Blumhouse obviously has made a whole thing out of this because that studio relies on the idea of, we make movies on a certain budget level and don't exceed that, with very few exceptions, Halloween, Exorcist. This movie, this is a studio film, you know. It's a Universal film given to filmmakers that basically they encouraged to come to their studio because, like, hey, you know, if you want to be part of Universal, we'll give you, you know, we'll treat you. We'll give you a real budget to work with or what have you.
Right.
So the problem right here, the way with this movie bombing, it's less about, you know, no place for mid-budget movies for this kind of thing. It's just more inconvenient scheduling, where all of April has been R-rated movies, which is not usual. And there's been a number of horror movies that have a similar thing going on. Like, we talked about The First Omen, which we both really liked, yet Immaculate came out a couple weeks earlier, is doing basically the same thing, and had a stronger marketing campaign. It had more buzz behind it, so it, you know, it did better. Well, The First Omen was, you know, also it was the same as this movie. It was a $30 million movie. Didn't have like the, you know, didn't have the buzz to work with on that one. We had what was the other one? We had Late Night with the Devil, which is a super cheap movie, made a good amount of money. There's just like, there's a lot of horror coming out. It's not about like there being too much horror. It's just more of the kinds of horror movies that they're showing.
Yeah.
And the amount of, you know, like what's at the movie theaters right now for people to see. It's a lot of stuff that looks somewhat similar. That's all coming out around the same time. It's like, that's just inconvenience. Like, there's, if you.
Yeah.
And also vampires, for whatever reason, aren't selling very well these days when it comes to horror movies. Like, you look, I mean, I mentioned Demeter and Renfield. Both of those movies bombed. Like, you know,
I remember.
And that's not necessarily new for vampire stuff. I don't have all the vampire movies in front of me, but like, I'm not gonna say ever since Twilight specifically, but like, because that's not a cause. That was, for one thing, those movies were ginormous. But in terms of like horror movie monsters, vampires haven't been like the big deal that they used to be in the realm of like scary horror movies.
Where are we now? Are we still back with zombies? That had its moment in like the early 2000s.
I think zombies zombies fits into like dystopia, so that's yes. like a broader thing in itself.
Yeah, and you're also bringing up a really good parallel, like of cultural themes, like cultural zeitgeist themes with horror movies.
Yeah,
and that you're right, because you know that post Y2K, and then also we're getting to like this recession period where people were not feeling great, and here comes like the zombie epics, right?
So yeah, you know. I mean, you could look at like Civil War, which is not a zombie movie per se, but it certainly had the kind
A24
of
movie.
Yes, you can look at like dystopian world, and there's things going on that you can kind of associate with how you get to the zombie movie.
Okay.
Where we're at, I mean, look at the Conjuring universe, right? We're in like ghostly possession type movies. Like that's kind of like where the hits are.
It's yeah.
Vampires, if I had to guess, I feel like you could sort of line them up in the same realm as superheroes, because they are the only characters that are like magic powers, cool, have this kind of own persona thing to them that I think closely aligns with like what you're getting out of superhero movies. It's just obviously in an R-rated realm. That's if I wanted to like delve more into that and think about it, I could probably like do more of a like one-to-one comparison, but I feel like that seems more somewhat likely, at least as far as like what kinds of characters you're going to see on screen. With mid-budget things in general, if you're, you know, back to your original question, I mean, like the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare came out this week. That's not mid-budget. That's like $70 million, $60 million. It's, you know, that's not super expensive, but it's not super cheap either.
Right.
But it's, I mean, it's, again, like R-rated guys with guns shooting stuff. There's a lot of that type of thing out there. Will we get back to more mid-budget things like being made and becoming successful? Time will tell.
Yeah, I hear you.
I think it's less about the budgets and more about the variety of stuff that you're getting.
True, yeah. You're hitting on a lot of different things here, and I want to hit on a couple of them. One of them is like the mid-budget thing. So the mid-budget thing I find fascinating because I feel like there's a contraction of, you know, the superhero genre at this point, which is not a bad thing. It's just more that, yes, I think everyone kind of is feeling the quote-unquote fatigue, or they kind of just feel like, well, we finished this one giant storyline that took 12 years, and we're still struggling to find like the next strand that we can produce more movies for. Totally fine, totally fair. And they're still got all their television, and you know, we're going to get Deadpool in a couple weeks or whatever.
I'd argue the television is part of what's caused their downfall. I mean, it's
sure, yeah.
Largely bad.
Yeah, and I've been on air kind of talking about how I've not caught up with everything there too. And then one of the things that you're also talking about that I asked you around was like mid-budget horror, or at least like, you know, this movie being distributed. Well, let's talk about the distribution part. This movie is distributed by Universal, like what you said. And I was looking things up on the back end here as you were chatting. First Omen is 20th Century Fox,
yeah.
Or 20th Century.
Yeah.
Major studio, right? Great, fantastic. Major studio releasing like this movie that did not do well in theaters, but I think that you and I are big fans of the director, Arkasha Stevenson. A great initial viewing. I'd be very curious what she does next, but I'm glad that a major studio took that leap. Immaculate Neon, so, you know, kind of niche. And then Late Night of the Devil, like what you mentioned, IFC Films, a little bit more, a little niche as well. What I want to also compliment the genre for, horror has always been a genre that while I don't watch it as much as you do and other guests of the show, I've always appreciated it for what it can do on its budget, but also what it can do just in the realm of what they're exploring. You know, whether this is a demonic possession, you know, we kind of said this earlier, the term rules, and you don't really do that with a lot of other genres. You don't really like, oh, what are the rules in this movie? You know, like, you and I have, we haven't patented it, but I was having a discussion with a buddy of mine for 28 years later. And one of the first things that come to mind is what we call fast acting zombies, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's really fun that these things can do these things, or these movies can have these different rules, but we all agree that it's the same thing. Like, these vampires are fine. And in this movie, Abigail, garlic doesn't work. None of the other shit works except for like stakes right through the heart and sunlight, right? So it's very fun that there's that we're on our toes for these types of things. So the again, horror I have a huge appreciation for. And I do hope that, you know, tying this all together, I do hope that large studios kind of give more credence to some of these things. Obviously there are failures, you know, Exorcist Believer, was it?
Uh-huh.
Was a failure, right? Like both commercially and was it a failure commercially?
It underperformed, would be the way.
Underperformed.
It's not a flop, definitely but it didn't. Yeah. Compared to like the kind of money they would hope to get, it didn't do nearly.
From
as...
a David Gordon Green, like from the director of Halloween 2018.
Yeah, then, like, and the money they paid for the just the rights to Exorcist.
Yeah.
They wanted it to be an event and it wasn't.
Yeah. So commercially, you know, underperformed, but critically failure, right? Like it was bad. And that it led to some damaging effects of we're not even going to. David Gordon Green walking off the project, and we're not even sure what's going to happen in the next two. And that is not good for major studio horror, although that was like Blumhouse and a couple, or Blumhouse that Universal?
Yeah, it was Universal.
So I like that there's some chances being taken from major studios at this point if they don't have like a large tentpole thing to do. And maybe this is also a cause and effect thing, right? So we had a strike, but Hollywood had a strike, and maybe they just have these smaller movies that they can push out because everything is being pushed out. The larger movies are being pushed out for months at a time, maybe like a year. And they have, you know, The First Omen. They're like, let's just put it out right now. Or they have this movie, Abigail and Lynn. Let's just put it out right now. So I don't know. I feel positive about what's happening with everything, even though the box office might not represent it. But my qualm is around the box office, which is like what you and I say, people can vote with their dollars. And if you're not voting with your dollars, then that doesn't give a lot of confidence to these major studios to make the movies like this and release movies like this. So it's like a weird catch 22. Like I'm hopeful, but I'm also like not hopeful.
Well, that's why you have to like apply the horror aspect of it all, because horror is never going to go away. Like they might not make as many costly horror films, but it's like that hasn't stopped horror from succeeding. It's like the lack of budget isn't a constraint for that specific genre. That's why it's an anomaly compared to like other stuff. If, like you said, look at this, you know, original romantic comedy featuring, you know, movie stars or whatnot that cost, you know, $40 million and it completely fails, that's when you're like, well, I guess we're not doing that again. And that, you know, that sucks because you're losing out on a certain type of audience that wants to see, you know, in addition to seeing Dev Patel beat up a bunch of guys and
that's a great example
and watching Godzilla run around. It's like sometimes you just want to, you know, a steady rom-com. And if you want to have a way to get people off of Netflix, which is currently producing rom-coms plenty, and get them to actually go to the theater to see something like that, something, you know, less spectacle and less complex and just more meat and potatoes movie, do that. But then people don't show up to it. It's like, well, why would we keep doing that? And it's like, that's the conundrum you find yourself in. Horror is just like,
also,
horror is just horror. I mean, you'll make more horror movies. That's always a cycle as well, as far as how far studios are willing to go to back a horror thing, let alone get away from how IP driven it might be in order to do something. Because like Abigail, this is an original, right? First Omen, you know, Omen was pretty, it was like a dead franchise, but they're like, here, let's get that Omen IP. And it was a risk, and like it worked out critically, but it sadly didn't, you know, they did everything right except get audiences to show up for it. That was the problem.
Yeah, it's a bummer. Right. you hit on something, which is the streamification of things too, which I forgot to factor in, right? So there is the Netflix does produce a lot of like rom-coms, or they do produce a lot of movies in general. And that has I don't want to be super critical, and this is not necessarily like the right episode to do this, but I am curious around like the film literacy of moviegoers today versus like moviegoers, you know, a decade ago or three decades ago. Not to say that we have this, I'm not talking about like the attention span stuff, But I have friends that will watch a movie that has been produced from on Netflix. That is, I think when I say that, you and I both have a connotation of, okay, well, I know what that feels like, and I know what that's written like, and I know how it's shot, you know what I mean? And that can sometimes be a killer to some of these movies that are smaller that come out in theaters, you know? Like, if you watched Extraction 2, and you're like, oh, well, this is a great action movie. Like, yeah, there are some good action sequence bits in it and parts in it because it's competently made from a stunt coordinator turned director guy. But then if you're like, oh, well, I went to go watch the Dev Patel movie, Monkey Man. And you're just like, well, you know, I don't know. It didn't really crack up to all that it was. It's like, They're very different in how they were made. You know, like Netflix is like, it feels like it's a little more hands off, like let me give you some money, and then I know that I'm going to get subscriptions and people watching this at any point in time, versus like Monkey Man is like, well, Dev Patel, again, we discussed on the episode, he is a person of color that does not get many leading roles. And when he does, they're like, you know, maybe like side character 1B, right? And that is not, it's hard to compete against that. And also, like, it feels, again, more prestige, right? So when you're watching Monkey Man, it feels like he has to give more of a story. And we discussed this in the review, which is he might have given too much story.
You're not wrong, but you're getting in the weeds as far as like what the general audience is looking for.
No, yeah.
And the general audience is just like, if Netflix can approximate a thing that they generally typically like seeing, like an Extraction 2, or any god awful Ryan Reynolds, Dwayne Johnson, Gal Gadot movies.
Like, when did that movie come out? Was that Red? Or no, it wasn't.
Red Notice.
Red, yeah.
But there's Red, but I mean, Ryan Reynolds has a bunch of them, right? There's The Adam Project, of course. And I mean,
how dare you make fun of Sean Levy, his best friend?
Well, it's wild that they've done three movies in a row together. Stop it. If the audience can see, like, on Netflix that there's something that resembles the kind of thing they like, they're not going to think that hard about it. It's like, oh, but Dev Patel is a person of color that I've never get to see in a lead role.
Yeah, I know.
It just doesn't go that far for them.
No, like,
I can get a babysitter and they can do this while I go see this movie, or I can watch this thing that's right here on Netflix in front of me and they're telling me that it's important because it has these stars and it costs this amount of money.
Right. Yeah. That's kind of like the end point too, is again, Netflix has a lot of movies. It produces a lot of movies. And so the easy answer is, well, I'll just wait for it to go on streaming. But then B is just, yeah, I don't know. This doesn't really pique my interest. And while I have a whole quote unquote library of movies here at my fingertips, even though they never have the movie that you actually want to see, which is unfortunate.
Well, there's so many streaming services, and you want to find something. Yeah, if you find something.
Yeah.
the issue that I have is that, like, if Netflix want to make crappy movies, fine, make all your crappy movies. I just wish they'd put them in theaters. they're
fascinating.
Theaters to help, like, to help the experience of going to the movies.
Yeah,
like the. From what I can tell, based on just like the numbers of it all, the promise of something coming to streaming doesn't super impact what the lifespan of a film in theatrical is going to be. And by that, I mean, if you have something that's going to Shudder, for example, like Late Night of the Devil,
yeah,
that's not making an audience be like, I'm not going to see this because it's going to be on Shudder. That doesn't seem to be a factor based on everything that I've seen and everything about the numbers. That doesn't seem to make a difference. But the only place it does make a difference is for Disney, because Disney's huge. It's its own thing.
Right.
And they've established that all their movies are on Disney Plus and they will go to Disney Plus. So that's why a movie like Wish or Encanto, because of their own choices regarding all their Pixar movies or whatnot, they've made it clear that, guess what? This kid's movie that you want to take your kid to, you can wait because it's going to be on Disney Plus soon, and it sucks. and I'll be very curious how well Inside Out 2 does, if that rights the ship, or if it's just another example of Pixar underperforming because Disney screwed them over with all their streaming stuff. Outside of that, though, when it comes to all these different movies that are going to be on streaming, that doesn't seem to stop audiences from the ones that want to see it in theater are still going to see it in a theater.
Of course. Yeah. But I mean, so, that volume is a little bit less than two.
No, I get that. But so if Netflix and Amazon, who does put their movies in theaters, so good for them.
A little bit better about that for sure. Yeah. Especially like the ones that they want to win awards.
Yeah, because they've bought MGM. So that helps them in that regard also.
How much money does Jeff Bezos have?
Have you seen his head? It's covered in hair now because of all that money.
it's Netflix, green dollar bills.
Netflix, though, as proven just easily by Glass Onion, that's just money. That, like, that's money they're leaving time. On the table.
Yeah,
that is, it is not hard for them to be like, oh, The Irishman, with Scorsese movie, put it in the theaters, put it in theaters for 4 weeks.
Right.
That's like, and then it comes to streaming. Done. That's money right there that they've already spent. There are everything they need to do to like make their profit or whatever they want to call it when it comes to these movies. It's already done. So like just putting something in theaters, that's not a risk to them. That's why these Apple movies can do whatever they do in theater. That's why Napoleon and The Gargoyle, they can bomb or whatever.
Yeah.
It's fine. Like they're not in trouble at all. Like there's no version of that movie that's a flop because it's going to be on Apple soon enough. It's good. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And Killers of the Flower Moon as well.
Yeah, Killers, which did make money.
Also at the same time, people were like, oh, well, you know, Apple is just like, we know we're trying to go for everyone was trying to achieve what Amazon achieved in that like first early run where they won an Oscar for.
They got Manchester by the Sea was like a big player, among other films.
Yes, but then they also got nominated for The Big Sick, right? So it was like, you know, I'm glad that streaming services are still doing the theater game. I hear what you're saying with Netflix, which again I have problems with, because they do things like Glass Onion, which we brought up last time, and I was like asking, like, you know, they could easily just extend this. It made money. I don't know why they didn't extend it. And you had a really long explanation, which was very satisfactory. I was like, I get it. It's just, you know, Netflix. Like, what are we doing here? So all this to say is that. Streaming services, they have a plethora of films that you can watch, but I do hope that people still go out and try to enjoy these movies in theaters, because I do have a strong fear, like who was like in talks to be purchased. There's a large studio that was in talks. Was it Paramount?
It's Paramount, but that's just, it's not happening.
But who are they?
Sony.
Okay. Yeah. So a large distributor kind of buying like a movie studio kind of thing. So not an Apple MG or Amazon MGM type situation.
No.
Yeah. Okay. But still,
these are bad things that would happen. I just want to note that like Disney buying Fox has been a terrible thing. I just need to make that clear. Like it's not been a good thing in the realm of like the movie sphere. That's why there's less movies now, because there's one less major studio.
One studio. Yeah.
And the studio that bought them only specializes in very specific things for their tentpoles. And guess what?
Right.
People are getting bored with that specific thing.
Yes,
that's why there's no Star Wars movie on the table right now beyond just, yeah, we're going to do one in 2025. Like, sure, right. Why not? Like, so like the idea of Sony buying Paramount's like, God, that'll be terrible again. Another like 13 movies less every year because of that.
And I hear that. And also I'm also bummed out whenever they buy them, because their prestige lines kind of like evaporate a little bit more quickly as well. Right. So 20th Century Fox, I don't know why I keep calling 20th Century Fox, but they've got their prestige line. And I don't think I've really seen anything from their line there was one recently.
What, for Fox?
Yeah.
Well, they have Searchlight, which keeps winning. They're doing great.
But
Disney's got what they wanted out of this, which is we have Best Picture Oscars and we have the biggest blockbuster tentpoles in the world. Like that's
right.
they're getting everything they want. It just sucks. It's like, yeah,
it does.
As a whole, if you really look at it, what it's doing to the movie ecosphere, that's not great. As far as Disney proving how much muscle they have, sure, they fucking killed it. Like, great for them, I guess.
Which is why, again, I dig that these smaller distributors and smaller studios are still in business, but that has also kind of gone by the wayside. If you go watch films from a decade ago, there's a lot of distributors that are not around anymore, and that's kind of a bummer.
I mean, there are still, I know what you're saying, because like a lot of it's like umbrella stuff that's not there anymore. Like Disney had Touchstone and Hollywood Pictures and all that. That's just and Miramax, and that just doesn't exist now.
Yeah, yeah.
There are plenty. There's Bleecker Street and STX and Neon and IFC and A24.
Right, right.
And the thing, if you want to end this on a hopeful note, the fact that Civil War not only did well in its opening weekend, but had a pretty good hold this weekend, that's good. I mean, and that's proof that it's not just like the major players, but it's not just like the buzz around Civil War that made it seem like a thing to have to see in the first week and then nothing happens afterwards. It's the fact that A24 has cultivated a certain brand.
Yeah.
And they spent the right kind of money to get people interested in this specific thing, in addition to all the other success that they've had in recent years. Like that's they are a small studio. Neon is similarly doing that. I mean, they've had a number of Best Picture winners at this point, and they have buzzy things, whether or not people whether or not people see them in droves. They have movies coming, you know, like that Maxine that, or that's A24, the Long Legs that's coming out, that the spooky movie with Michael Monroe and Nicolas Cage from Oz Perkins.
Yeah,
I love how they're selling it. I mean, and that connects with, you know, the Gen Z crowd and the TikTok crowd and the people that go to the movies more. I mean, it's.
I was just laughing because I've never heard you say Gen Z before.
And I never will again. It's only for this bonus episode.
But I hear what you're saying. I think that, just to reply to that very quickly before we get back to, you know, Abigail, I guess, A24 has come a long way. And it has established itself, and Neon has come a long way too in terms of it getting a lot of nominations, and now people kind of are aware of Neon and its prestige factor. But you know, I miss things like Film District or something like that, where it either got eaten up or it kind of just like lost its way because they ran out of money, kind of thing, right? But still, it is hopeful. By seeing a movie like Abigail be distributed by Universal, seeing that logo appear on the screen, and then just them allowing these guys that did well, I guess that they had some pre-work because they had the screen movies.
Well, they're coming off of two huge successes, and a breakout hit with Raider Nod. So,
but I guess I should more be talking about the First Omen then, like for a first-time director who's not really super proven, but coming from 20th Century, pretty good. So. Again, hope, but I hope that and tying it all back together into horror, I don't think ever goes away. It will never go away. And also it will always have, like what you're saying, like a built-in audience, no matter what it is, because people like to experience the different the differences in this. You know, like we talked about Twisters, the trailer, like a while ago, and it's like we kind of both probably know what that movie is going to present, right? So versus
I'm excited
like
for Twisters. So,
I'm not dissing it, but like it's going to be a movie about heroism and, you know, special effects and whatever else versus like something like, oh, well, I'm curious, like what Late Night of the Devil is all about, you know, and then you telling me because I didn't see it, but you tell me the premise like, oh, you know, it's built on a late night Dick Cabot type show. Where he's like, he's down in ratings, so he's like, let's just have an exorcism on screen. I'm like, this is crazy, right? Yeah. So I was like, see, that's like the stuff that horror can do. It's like, no, like, let's just like take this genre and like, you know, do whatever we need to with it. And that's always fun for the creative minds out there. So anyway, Abigail, go see it.
When do people see Abigail?
I agree with you that it's not really one of those things that is like super repeatable. But I did enjoy it. So either Dollar Theater, but I'm honest, it's probably like HBO streaming, HBO like premium streaming.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a Dollar Theater makes sense to me. I do think like with an audience, there's like fun to be had, like watching this movie.
The other two people in the room with you.
Yeah, people like Dollar Theaters.
No, I'm saying like the audience for Abigail itself was not very strong. So it's like it'd be like two people with
you. Yeah, I hear you. But no, I think the movie is fun enough where like if you make it to like a you know, cheap matinee showing, like there's something to be gained there. And yeah, that's gonna do it for this bonus episode. You can find this podcast everywhere you can find podcasts. You know where to find this podcast. Stay tuned. We have plenty of fun stuff coming your way, including the 12th annual summer movie gamble prediction episode.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, that's going to do it for this bonus episode. So until next time, so long.
And those are fucking onions.
How lucky can one guy be? I kissed her and she kissed me. Like the fella once said, ain't that a kick in the head? The room was completely black. I hugged her and she hugged back. Like the sailor said, quote, ain't that a hole in a boat? My head keeps spinning. I go to sleep and keep grinning. If this is just the beginning, my life is gonna be beautiful. I've sunshine enough to spread. It's just like the fella said. Tell me quick, ain't love a kid?